from WVUR Boston. I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point.
Imagine peace. Imagine peace.
When Yoko Ono met John Lennon in 1966, the link was made between pop art, the music of the Beatles, and the avant-garde. Lennon went there, David Bowie, Lady Gaga, lots of others now. And Yoko Ono? She was always ready to be at the frontier. Next year, she'll turn 80. She's still at it. This hour, On Point, artist, activist, Yoko Ono is with us. You can join the conversation. When did you first spot Yoko Ono? What's your question for her now on a long life in art, politics, the world? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK, and you can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Behind us right there, Healing, Yoko Ono and the latest Plastic Ono Band, the song off her 2009 album, Between My Head and the Sky. Later this hour, we'll hear an excerpt of my 2006 interview with screenwriter and author Nora Ephron, who died yesterday at 71. But joining us now from New York is Yoko Ono. Born in Tokyo in 1933 to a high-placed Japanese family, suffered in and after World War II, spent years of her youth in the United States, has made a remarkable life in art and beyond. There's a big career-spanning exhibition of her work at London's Serpentine Gallery through September, and she has a book out, too. It's called An Invisible Flower, a book of text and her illustrations originally composed when she was just 19 years old. Yoko Ono in New York, welcome to On Point. It's wonderful to have you with us.
Hi, Tom. This is Yoko.
Hi. Thanks so much for being here. And I have to say, I really enjoyed this book. It's full-page illustrations with just a little text along the side. And you write in the afterword, Yoko, that this takes you back to a time when you were evacuated from Tokyo to the countryside during the Second World War. I did not know this history. What happened then?
Well, you know, it was pretty incredible. Well, I wouldn't say depressing. Some days were good, but evacuating in the country and not being in Tokyo, which was my hometown. And all children had to sort of do that in a way. And we were not getting too much food, and the farmers didn't like city people.
Mm-hmm,
you
right.
know, they were saying, well, you had your day, and this is our day or something. Mm-hmm. So we weren't getting too much to eat. But still, the sky was beautiful. I remember the beautiful wheat field and all that. It all seemed like a Van Gogh's painting or something. It was great.
Mm-hmm. I want to go to that invisible flower, but place us before we get there, Yoko. You'd come from quite a prominent family, kind of an upper-class family in Tokyo. Your father was a banker, and do I have it right, even before the war, you had lived briefly in San Francisco with your dad and family, is that correct?
Yes, yes. And New York. I lived in New York a little too, and until the war, just before the war started, we all went back to our country.
Do you have any memories of the United States, of San Francisco or New York before the war?
Oh, yes, yes, of course. In San Francisco, I love San Francisco because that's the first city that I encountered in America, and it was beautiful. And in those days, we didn't travel by planes. You know, it was a ship, you know. Mm-hmm. A liner, and my father came up on a liner, and I remember my father standing there, and behind him was this beautiful city shining, and the sky, and all that.
Wow, great memories. And were you or just your father in Vietnam as well in those days?
Yes, he was in Vietnam after that, and in a concentration camp.
During the war, he ended up in a concentration camp.
Yeah, during the war, yeah.
Who was he a prisoner of? Of French or American or Chinese? Or who took him prisoner?
I think the Vietnamese or French or Vietnamese. Oh, not French, Vietnamese, yeah.
Yeah. And then there's your experience in Tokyo and beyond during the war. What about that? I mean, Tokyo was firebombed during the war by American planes. The devastation was quite
Quite something.
Historic in its scale.
Exactly. But, you know, for a child, that's the only reality that you know. So, for instance, late at night, there was a bomb, a big bomb coming, and I saw that from the window. Everything was fired, under fire, and the fire was beautiful. That's what I thought. Wow. It was beautiful. Yeah.
But eventually, there wasn't enough food there. There wasn't enough anything. You headed to the countryside, and if I read this correctly, you were just kind of carrying everything you had in a wheelbarrow. I mean, you came from a wealthy family, and suddenly you were, as you were saying, literally just on the road, I guess, scavenging for food.
Well, it's not so much wheelbarrow. I don't know where that story came from.
Okay.
It's not from me. But you know, the thing is, my mother decided to buy a house, the sort of a country farmhouse. She was such a romantic person. So she thought, well, you know, do it like this, Andrew, you know, like a symphony of day in and also. And then the thing is, what happened was they didn't finish the farmhouse roof. So only one or two rooms had roofs was over it.
Wow.
It was pretty amazing, and, you know.
Open to the sky.
Open to the sky. It was beautiful, actually.
You know, you're quoted on so many things, and I never know what is actually what you've said or not, but you're quoted saying that your sort of outsider view of life, even your kind of sometimes aggressive attitude about life, came from this time of trial, when you were in the countryside. There was a lot of hunger, even starvation then, and how did that shape you?
Well, I think that it's true that, you know, the experience I had then was really very, very precious, very important for me, because otherwise I would have just, stayed in the kind of environment that I was born in, and that would not have helped me to understand about the whole world. So I'm very happy that I did have that experience.
Now you've got this book, which your son Sean apparently found looking through your old things, these drawings and a little text that go with them.
And it's so funny because Sean is the one who insisted that I put this book out, you know. And I thought, well, why? I mean, you know, when I was 19, you know. And the idea that I had about invisibility and conceptual things came from that period when I was evacuated in the country. And that was when I was about 9 or something.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So 19 sounded like very late. And I thought, well, I had all the beautiful things from when I was younger than that, but they were all burnt or, you know, lost. And now we have this 19, when I was doing 19, that's not very early. And he said, no, it should be out. It should be out. Mm-hmm. And so I put it out, and it was all to do with his insistence, and I'm very happy that he did, because just now I came back from London, and in London, Hayward Gallery, there's an exhibition of invisible paintings. Can you imagine?
Once again, you're ahead of the curve.
I know, and there's so many invisible paintings that happened, you know, like in 1965, 75, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, well, maybe it was good that we put it out, you know.
You were talking here about an invisible flower. I mean, it's the flower we don't see in this book. There's many very impressionistic kind of, I can see a young conceptual artist budding here. What's the story behind it? With the flower, you said there was a farm boy pointed out whether he thought there was one.
Yeah. Well, I mean, afterwards. But I mean, the point is, yes, I made this story up, you know, about an invisible flower. And the only person who was able to see it was a guy named Johnny. And of course, I didn't know any John at the time.
Right.
So it's a very strange story. And so Sean immediately picked up on it and said, well, I think this Johnny's daddy. I said, what? But I didn't know him, and I didn't know anybody whose name was John.
Daddy, as in John Lennon. You somehow anticipating with your smelty John in the story that you might meet a John. Your son Sean now thinks.
Yeah, but that I wrote in 1952,
mm-hmm.
and we have a crayon drawing of John that has that says he drew this on February 18th, which is my birthday, February 18th, 1952, the same year.
That's kind of
amazing.
Isn't
that amazing?
Yes, it is amazing. It is amazing.
And the drawing is about a guy on a horse, and there's another, a woman. It seems like a woman or guy, a smaller person with dark hair on another horse, and they're sort of like, you know, going around together.
Maybe a connection, what, a dozen, 14 years before you ever met John Lennon. Maybe you each feeling something there. Who knows how the world works? I love
Isn't
the
that amazing.
It is amazing. Did you draw this in Japan, or were you back in the States? You lived in New York, Scarsdale, after the war. Was this drawn in the States or Japan, Yoko?
No, in Japan.
Ah.
I mean, we had crayons, please.
Yeah. And there it is. There's so much we want to hear and learn with you in this hour. Yoko Ono is with us. Please stand by there in New York, Yoko. The new book of drawings, a little text with him, is called An Invisible Flower. There's a big exhibition of Yoko Ono's work currently showing at London's Serpentine Gallery through September. It's called Yoko Ono to the Light. You can join us this hour. What do you want to know after all these years from Yoko Ono? What's your question on her history, her passions, the way she sees life? And what's the moment, the event, when Yoko Ono first caught your attention? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back with Yoko Ono. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Yoko Ono about her life and art, loves, and activism. Behind us right there, from way back, 1968, Unfinished Music number 1, Two Virgins, John Lennon and Yoko Ono, with an example of the kind of out-there music, tape loops, distortion, improvised vocals, that always put Yoko Ono kind of in a place of her own, certainly way out in front of the pop mainstream. She bridged that gap when she met John Lennon in 1966. She joins us today. She's 79 now, a lot of years behind us, but a lot of life as well, as she's just gone on and on with it. Here's a little bit from 1969. After getting married, John Lennon and Yoko Ono turned their honeymoon famously into a bed-in, protesting violence, calling for peace, inviting the press into their Amsterdam hotel room every day for a week. Here's John and Yoko.
We're going to stay in bed for 7 days, sort of, instead of having a private honeymoon. It's a private protest.
For the violence that's going in the world, you see.
To say,
we feel that instead of making war, it's better to just stay in bed. Let's stay in bed for the spring.
And grow your hair.
Yes.
For peace. Let it grow till peace comes. You know?
So this is part of your honeymoon?
Yes.
Yes, yes.
And how are you enjoying married life?
It's beautiful, you know. It's beautiful.
It's beautiful, it's beautiful. 1969, the bed-in, famous bed-in of John and Yoko Ono, John Lennon and Yoko Ono. She joins us today from New York. She's out with a new, in a way, old book of drawings and a little bit of a story from way back when she was 19 years old. Yoko, we've got a lot of callers for you. May I go to them?
Oh, sure.
Winston, Connecticut. Mike is calling. Mike, you're on the air with Yoko Ono.
Hi, Mike.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi, Yoko.
Hi.
Hi, I just, I'm sorry. I was actually, Tom had mentioned, when did you first notice Yoko, and when did you first, become conscious of that? Of course, I'm a little bit younger, so I wasn't around when the Beatles were first, famous and doing their thing,
yeah.
But I noticed the Rolling Stone cover where you guys had posed naked and John was kind of clinging to the side of you. And I was just wondering, I mean, was that your concept, and or was that the concept of the photographer? I mean, how did that photo come about? Because I think it's a really iconic photo, and it really, you know, it's, photo says 1,000 words, and that really kind of, I think, you know, portrayed the emotion, at least the perceived emotion you know, that you don't really get a look at, you know. I thought I was moved by that, so.
Unforgettable. Yoko, how did that come about?
Well, actually, John thought of it. The reason he thought of it was, what we both agreed on, which is we felt that photography was really a separate reality and not so much the true person. And we wanted to show the real self. Of us. So, so this is not so beautiful. We didn't have the right lighting and, you know, makeup, nothing, you know. So it was a bit embarrassing, really. But we said, okay, you know, I'm going to give you the truth, you know, that kind of thing. And John, very strangely, didn't want anybody to be in the room when we were naked. So he closed the door to our bedroom. And he's the one actually did the filming, mm-hmm. photographed it.
Mm-hmm. But you were
by
not a stranger.
The delayed switch, what?
You were not a stranger to this kind of performance art. I mean, if you go back to one of your very early pieces, I think it was called Cut Piece.
Yes, yes. But of course, you know, it was very different then. I could not, I wanted to in a way, but most of the time because I felt the danger or something so that I was not showing my total self.
But this was a piece in which has been described, it's been performed many times now by you and by others, is often described as really moving, where you're on stage, you've got kind of
yes.
robe on, I guess, and the audience, you always mm-hmm. broke that wall between audience and artist. The audience is invited to come up, take big scissors, and gradually cut that robe, pieces of it away from you, cut it off of you.
So, okay, so I was like that. When Two Virgins, the photo happened, I'm sure that I was thinking about it, you know, and I'm sure that John was thinking about that too. I don't know. But so, yes, I did that a long time before I met John. And, yes, it was a little bit dangerous. Well, I mean, it was a little bit scary.
You were always on that avant-garde front. After the war, you came back to the States, lived in New York or outside New York in Scarsdale. How did you get drawn to the sort of Dadaism and the avant-garde?
Well, I think that the history shows that the Japanese avant-garde started like 1920s around that mm-hmm. time, and mm-hmm. there are many published documents about that and magazines and print about it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not too known in this country. But so, you know, it was something that was there already. And I think it came mostly from Russia at the time because Russia was very, mm-hmm.
Forward-leaning, yeah.
Yeah, close to Japan. Mm-hmm. So it was naturally all the Japanese artists leaned on getting information from Russia, I think.
You had some difficult emotional times in your teenage years. Many, many young people do. Was that related to you searching through this avant-garde art for some framework for understanding the world?
Definitely. I think that and this is sort of repeatedly happening to my son in a way, strangely. But I was born in a very, very famous family or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody in that family was kind of, my uncle, one uncle was a painter, one uncle was a sculptor, and my mother was a painter, and my father was a very good pianist and mm-hmm. musician. So the thing is, I thought, well, where could I go? You know, I don't want to repeat that act, you know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So in a way, I had to find my own gig.
You went to very elite schools in Japan. We have this stretches the point, but almost a mutual friend in the Emperor of Japan now, Akihito, who I used to live in Tokyo, and he and his family were very warm and friendly before he became emperor as a journalist. I spent some time with them. You went to school with him.
He's a very kind and beautiful guy, yes.
What do you think determines why one person becomes an artist and another? Here you were with Akihito, now the emperor.
Yeah.
You know, of course, he's obligated to follow a more conventional, in his own terms, life. But what determines which person becomes that avant-garde artist and which one, you know, sees the strangeness of life or the difficulty or the challenges, but yet remains quite conventional?
Well, because my father and my mother did the same thing. My mother wanted to be, well, she was a very good painter, but she could not make that into a career because in those days it was very difficult for women to do that. But also, in her case, she fell in love with my father. I mean, it's a classic story in every way in the world. But and then she got married and she had two children. You know, it's a different story. Well, with my father, my grandfather said that he should become our inherited tradition of being a banker. Mm. And, you know, I don't know. Both of them didn't have enough courage to get out of it. And They had a beautiful life. From other people, it would look like, oh, well, you know, they have great, great life, very lucky people. But they were not very happy inside. And I didn't want to be one of them.
I wonder about when you met John Lennon. Here he was. The Beatles had been such a huge, everybody knew it, I'm sure you knew it, pop sensation. But there you were, mm-hmm. the avant-garde young woman.
Yeah.
The Beatles, of course, they broke boundaries themselves over time, but you know, I was reading here, I mean, this is a Bloomberg Business Week of all things, and they're saying that the day in 1966 when you met Lennon, the link between popular music and the artistic avant-garde was made, saying you became a rock performer, he turned into a collaborator in your performances and films. Since then, many others from Bowie to Gaga have blended pop and cutting-edge art. Did you and John Lennon talk about that? Was it open and explicit that you were bringing a new perspective to him?
Well, we didn't see it that way. I mean, you know, that's for the critics. You know, we lived mm-hmm. it, so mm-hmm. you know, it's a different story. Mm-hmm. He loved my work, and I was sort of tickled with rock and roll in a way. I thought it was great to do that because the classic music was starting to die a little, you know, because they were so composed. But rock and roll wasn't composed yet. It was like wild a little. So it was exciting that way. And I like that excitement.
And Yoko Ono at 79, still at it. Here's a little bit. This is called Early in the Morning. This is Yoko Ono, Thurston Moore, Kim Gordon. She announced last week that she would collaborate on an album with Gordon and Moore of Sonic Youth. One track from the album already out is Early in the Morning, already released. Here's a bit from that. Yoko Ono and Friends. Early in the Morning, Yoko Ono there with Thurston Moore and Kim Gordon, known from Sonic Youth. This is just one track from an album headed out called Early in the Morning. Sounds like no theater to me, Yoko. That's one.
Well, you know, we're trying to break the tradition. So if you are sort of a little bit startled, I understand.
You still clearly really enjoy performing. What do you enjoy most these days? Music or you name it?
Music, art. Art is very important for me too. And of course, you know, there's a lot that we can do to change the world through art. And that's what I'm trying to do now. And I'm very, very happy about that.
Let's bring in our listeners, Linda in Howell, Michigan. Linda, you're on the air with Yoko Ono.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Yoko.
Hi.
I just wanted to ask you, what would you contribute to your physical longevity? I mean, every time I see you, you look fantastic, and I just, it's possible you're going to be 79. How can I live a long, fruitful life like you?
Well, you know, the secret is not knowing what the secret is. I don't really know, you know. It's like, it's better to not know, and just you know, keep trotting. Well, maybe being busy has a lot to do with it too, you know. But I think that everything comes from our brain. Everything that that happens to our body comes from the brain. And what I notice is that I keep my brain pretty empty. And so that all that information can come in. When you have a brain where you fill up with all sorts of experience or anger or sadness and all that, you know. And then, you know, there's no way that any beautiful information can come in. So keep your mind, keep your brain empty as possible.
I'm Tom Ashbrook with Yoko Ono with a little Zen advice there, Linda. This is on point. She asks about your longevity. What about your, I don't know, your lifestyle, your diet? Do you eat Japanese? You live in New York. Or do you eat New York strip sirloin steaks?
Well, I'm very concerned about health mm-hmm. in terms of spiritually, mentally, and physical. And what I try to do is do my best to keep it going. And but sometimes, of course, I love sweets. So don't erase that, because then I get so many sweets from people. So they, but anyway, so yeah, well, I do like sweets, and so it's very difficult for me not to have a little chocolate there or here. But then, instead of saying, "Oh, I did it, so I should just forget about not having sweets," I go back to not having, and it's very good. And gradually, I'm starting to get like I don't even eat chocolate. Isn't that amazing? So, and things like that can happen, yeah, you know.
Kind of cycles there. Jesse in Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts. Jesse, you're on with Yoko Ono.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Mm-hmm.
Hi.
Yoko, I wonder if you would mind speaking a little bit about being half of a biracial couple at a time in the United States when people were pretty uptight about that. Less uptight, more uptight perhaps than today.
A Japanese young woman, a British guy. What about that?
Yeah, you know, we thought that it's, well, we didn't plan it that way, but, you know, we thought it was a very good model of, you know, a couple in that sense, because people might start thinking it's all right to marry somebody of another race, etc. And that's what, you know, we didn't do that for that, but it was there. And also the fact that one is a rocker and one is an avant-gardist or something, you know. I mean, anything could happen. All bridges are being created everywhere when you want to.
So a lot of people were pretty tough on you in those days. There's the old thing, Yoko broke up the Beatles. But did you attribute some of that to your race, to racism, or not, as you experienced
that? I don't know. Well, look, it's a very complex situation. Mm-hmm. Racism, yes, definitely. But you can't blame them, because they were at war with each other at one point, you know. So, and especially English, you know, they never forgot that, and they were fighting Japanese at one point or something. So those were a very difficult situation. And also, people are not used to women artists, so that's another thing. But also, I'm not an ordinary artist. I'm just the avant-garde, which is something that most people don't take to. So all three of those things were mm-hmm. very bad. Now, I think that now I have one thing that I never thought I would have to cope with, ageism. It's a very interesting situation, and I'm experiencing it.
How does it show up?
What? Well, I don't know. They have a very set idea about people over, what is it, over 40, is it, or 50? So
or 60,
all of you
or
so
70.
Afraid. Yeah, all of you are so afraid. I have friends who are saying, oh, I'm going to be 30. I don't know what to do, you know. And I'm thinking, please relax about it, you know.
Right.
I really felt that when I was 70, my life started to take a very, very beautiful road again. In other words, I was starting to say, well, how did I become 70? Oh, that's amazing, you know. And I just had a little pride about it, mm-hmm. that I did well, I survived, and I must have done something right to survive, etc., you know. But of course, it's not just that. I mean, you can think about DNA, et cetera. But.
Yeah, it's all there. Yoko Ono's new book is An Invisible Flower. She joins us today from New York. Go out here with Every Man Has a Woman Who Loves Him from Yoko and John Lennon's 1980 album Double Fantasy. Listeners, you can join us. How do you weigh a life like Yoko Ono's? 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Yoko, please stand by in New York. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
evaporate. Come back as rain. You evaporate, and I never see you again. Hopefully.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Yoko Ono about her life and art, loves, and activism. She joins us today from New York. She's out with a new book, An Invisible Flower, from way back when she was 19 years old. Big exhibition of her life and work currently at London's Serpentine Gallery through September. It's called Yoko Ono to the Light. Behind us right here, Yoko Ono. She's going on 80 now. This is just from 2009, her album Between My Head and the Sky with her Plastic Ono Band, the album of the same name. You can join us this hour. Can you imagine living a life of so much fame and heartbreak and passion and activism and art? How do you weigh a life like Yoko Ono's? 423-8255, 800-423-8255 is our number. In a few minutes, we'll hear from a few minutes of my last conversation with Nora Ephron, who died yesterday at 71. You never know what we're going to get. Lots of callers for you, Yoko, in New York. Pamela in Beverly, Massachusetts. You're on the air with Yoko Ono.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
And hello, Yoko. I'm very pleased to be able to be with you today. 1980, December 1980, I was the front desk receptionist at your law firm in downtown Manhattan. And I weigh a life by what you have given back to the community. Upon John's unfortunate death, you had put out a release asking for donations to the Spirit Foundation. And I was the person who collected all of those donations and deposited them in the bank. So I have a long and very knowledgeable history of what you've given back to the planet besides your art and music.
Well, it's very interesting because, well, thank you for mentioning this story because, you know, I feel sort of close to you. I'm sure you went through everything with us at the time. But John just said we should, you know, set up a foundation. And actually, 1980 is when we set up the Spirit Foundation. And it's amazing why we thought of doing that, you know, because, well, if we didn't do it in 1980, it would have been a very different situation. And so this foundation is very precious for me because it's something that John was still alive and we did it together.
And that call from that month of course, John's terrible murder there, December 1980 in New York, everybody who was around at that time remembers where they were, remembers that news. And Beverly, you with a very direct experience of that time and all that came after. Did that experience push you to go on more with your peace activism, your political activism, or did that really grow out of earlier things in your life, Yoko, even out of your experience in the war?
Well, of course, you know, I was an activist before I met John, you know, and John was too, actually. Mm-hmm. He wanted to put out an album that had sort of like a message about the Vietnam War kind of thing, about violence. And he couldn't do that because the record company didn't want them to do it. So he was aware of it, too. And when we met, we just knew that we had to do something together, you know, about that. But so when we were doing it together, we were very serious about it. You know, in the bed-in and voiceover, if you wanted, you know, that kind of thing, give peace a chance, you know. And we did our best. But when John passed away, I really felt an incredible, intense anger that he had to go. And I kept watching the TV all night, all day. So, who did it? What happened? You know, and I couldn't take my eyes off the TV news to find out what happened. You know, and of course I was reading newspapers as well. But anyway, so that's how it was. It was very, very difficult for me at the time. But still, I heard that some girls jumped off the roof or something. You know, because John died and they wanted to follow him or something. So that's when I woke up and said, we have to do something. I have to help them. John and I were like soldiers in a battlefield together. And he was right next to me and he fell. That means that I never thought that I would give up. I never thought that I should give up. I was just doing it for John and me.
The The renowned historian, art historian Simon Schama, described you as a radically adventurous multimedia innovator, and he said you would, he thought, would be world famous had you never met John Lennon. Had you never met the beloved Beatle? Can you imagine, after all these years, what life might have been like if you and John Lennon had not crossed paths?
Well, you see, the thing is, I was already being asked in avant-garde to do this, do that, come to Berlin to do a show. And that's why, you know, and that was one of the things. I mean, there were many things. But when we got together, I said to John Wong, you know, they asked me to go to Berlin to the show. And I had this great idea, and I was telling him, you know, about all these plastic stands on the stage, nobody, mm-hmm. but these stands will have tape recorder in it or whatever, you know, the drums in, and they'll be playing it. And he said, oh, okay, like this. And he just put all these little sort of plastic things, that empty plastic cassette box or, you know, those things on a table. And, well, let's call it Plastic Ono Band. That's how Plastic Ono Band was made, you know. Mm. So he was very concerned and aware of the fact that I was already a pretty famous person, and not in the biggest way like the Beatles, but in the avant-garde or whatever.
You were so bold then. Has that changed with time? I mean, your performance, Cut Piece, people would cut your robe away to nudeness here. Beth writes to us from Mansfield, Yoko. She says when she started studying feminist art and performance art, Yoko Ono's Cut Piece was one of the most powerful uses of audience participation. She says, I still get a shiver when I think about the concept of that piece. She says, I only wish I'd been born to see it performed. The image of Ono sitting, wild woman hair, demure look, down, is one I think of often. When's the last time you performed it, Yoko?
I'm performing this thing called performance art now. They call it performance art.
Yeah.
When I was doing it, there was no name. But anyway, so whenever I have a museum show or something like that, they tell me, do you want to do performance art as well? I often do it. So the one that I did, the last one I did was last month in Stockholm, I think, because I have an art show there.
And how does it feel now? You're not in your 20s anymore. Do people still come forward and cut your robe away? And how do you feel as an artist doing it?
I am not doing cut piece. Let's
okay. Okay. Kathy,
well,
sorry.
You can interpret that as maybe becoming a little bit, I don't know, cowardly or whatever. But no, I did it. I made it. I made a statement, so I don't have to do it again.
Mm-hmm. Kathy in Newport News, Virginia, you're on with Yoko Ono.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Yoko.
Hi.
My question is about the film On Holy Mountain. I've seen it a couple of different times, and it's very abstract and very, very vibrant, but could really settle on the meaning of it. So I just wanted to know if, Yoko, you would go into why you financed this and what importance it had to you.
Financed what? I mean,
The Holy Mountain, Alejandro Jodorowsky?
Oh, yes, yeah. Yes, yes.
Psychedelic kind of surreal film from the 1970s.
We were both very impressed with it, and that should come out again. but I don't think, you know, I mean, right now probably they're thinking about it, but it's not out now. But it just gave us an incredible symbiotic feeling because both of us were saying that, you know, we're the kind of people who would go to the topmost person and have a dialogue or something and make sure that we come out on the top and go on, you know. And that's what this film was doing that. And it's very interesting in a strange way it was doing it. And, you know, we felt like we were sort of, people of going through life of a spiritual path, you know. And so the spiritual path is very important for us, important at the time too. And that's what we saw in that film.
Let me get one more call, if I may, Yoko. New York, Hartsdale, New York. Craig, you're on with Yoko Ono.
Yes. Hi, Tom and Yoko.
Hi.
Tom, you asked what first attracted me to Yoko. I have to confess that I sort of fell in love with her voice during an interview that she and John were giving on the radio. And there is a sweetness and a an evolved style of functioning of her nervous system that just really captivated me.
Well, I mean, I think you're very unusual.
She says she thinks you're very unusual, Craig. I don't know. What's your question now, Craig?
I've been told that by many people.
Good for you.
Sure.
Good for you.
Well, thank you anyway.
I was attracted when John and the Beatles went to India to study with the sage Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. It created quite a stir. And when they left, it was under some unusual, strange circumstances. I read in the press that a few years ago, Yoko went to a fundraiser by the David Lynch Foundation to raise money to teach Maharishi's transcendental meditation to disadvantaged youth. And I was wondering what Yoko thinks about what John would say about such efforts today.
Yoko?
Well, you see, John was not against the transcendental meditation. He was a meditator. He was always meditating. I think there was a certain circumstances that he witnessed in the Maharishi's mountain. He was not very happy about him. And you know, they were sort of like getting food that was not... Well, John was all right about the food, but some of them, I won't name who, could not stand the food there or something, you know. And they were giving us very good... it seems like they were getting very good food, but it's a very different kind of food, you know. So it did hit some people. But anyway, so those things occurred, but it had nothing to do with John's fundamental interest in...
Meditation. Yoko Ono, it's been great talking with you. You're really something at 79, and we hope you keep performing and going right on with everything you do. An Invisible Flower is the new book from way back when Yoko Ono was 19. She joined us today from New York. Yoko Ono, thank you very, very much for being with us today.
It was my pleasure.
It's a big exhibition of Yoko Ono's art, To the Light, at London's Serpentine Gallery through September this year. Yoko Ono, thanks for joining us. In a moment, we remember the iconic writer-director Nora Ephron. She died yesterday at 71. Behind us right here, we've got Walking on Thin Ice, Yoko Ono, remixed by Jason Pierce. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Author, screenwriter, director Nora Ephron cast a sharp, hilarious eye on aging, womanhood, relationships. She crafted classic films like Sleepless in Seattle, Julie and Julia, and more. Her words resonated with generations of women, and men too, and shaped a culture. She died yesterday at 71 in New York City after a long battle with leukemia, private battle. Here's a scene from Nora Ephron's 1989 classic When Harry Met Sally with Billy Crystal and Meg Ryan.
Difficult. I'm too structured. I'm completely closed off.
But in a good way.
And I'm gonna be 40.
When?
Someday.
In 8 years.
It's not the same for men. Charlie Chaplin had babies when he was 73.
Yeah, but he was too old to pick them up.
I spoke with Nora Ephron in 2006 about her collection of essays, I Feel Bad About My Neck. She shared her thoughts about living life to the fullest, indulging, because you never quite know when your time in this world is up.
You never want to be there saying to yourself, oh, I never went to Barcelona. One of the things I write about in my book is just bath oil, about being stingy with bath oil. Don't be stingy with your bath oil, because tomorrow you could get some really bad news from the doctor and you're going to feel like an idiot that you were saving 5 cents on bath oil. Another thing that I have definitely moved into in a careful but enthusiastic way are carbohydrates. Because when you
wild.
Get to the life is too short thing, you know, bread is great. Bread and butter, bread and salted butter, have some. It's just great. You know what I mean? You just,
sure,
you're
sure
constantly in a dilemma over, am I going to live forever? Or am I going to die tomorrow? You don't know which the truth is going to be, but on the chance you're going to die tomorrow or next week or next year, bread, 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 have a little.
Also,
I'll tell you another thing. You do not have to have only one dessert. You know that horrible moment when you're going, I just don't know whether to have the chocolate one or the lemon one? Just order them both. At the end of the year, what are we talking about? $100 in extra money? And you could taste both of them.
You know, you raise the word that floats behind all this. You write in the word in the book that you know, sometimes dance around the D word. You write, when you cross into your 60s, death is a sniper. I mean, it's out there. It's a factor behind all this humor.
Yes, and it's a fact for people after a certain age, and that's the thing that nobody likes to really talk about. But that's the truth.
You've lost friends already. How do you deal with it? How do you make it go right along with the extra dollop of bath oil and the loaf of bread? It's
well,
so big.
You do what you can. But the truth is that the sad truth is that as you get older, your friends become more and more important to you. You trust fewer and fewer of them in the real way that we were just talking about, the ones that you really do talk intimately to. So when you lose a good friend, it feels like, you know, the death of an army, because that was what that friend was for you.
Does it make the manicure more or less important at
some
point?
No, the manicure is not important. It's just a fact. Do you know what I mean? It's just a thing we do. It's that weird thing we all know about, which is that we are capable of going from really important things to really unimportant things in a flash, unless, of course, you're Mother Teresa, who probably did not care about her nails, let's face it. But who is Mother Teresa? Not me.
Author, screenwriter, director, Nora Ephron. We last spoke there in 2006, and what a pleasure it always was. She died yesterday in New York City. She was 71. To hear my full conversation with Nora Ephron, go to our website, onpointradio.org. We thank her for all of her creativity and humor over the years. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us today. This is On Point. ¶¶